Board of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. Good
morning. Please be seated. We're going to take first Prince versus State Farm. Party's ready? Great.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is James Mendel. I'm here on behalf of the appellant State Farm Insurance Company. If I were to move away from this pulpit right now, take off my coat and whip down my pants and expose myself to you, I'd be in violation of a crime. I'd be tackled, taken out of here, and prosecuted to the fullest, and rightfully so. The plaintiff, in this case the respondent, did a similar such thing and did not receive any penalty in accordance with RCW 7.06.050.
Of course, that statute doesn't quite rise to the level of a criminal statute, and the legislature didn't, it said shall not make a premature disclosure of an offer and compromise, didn't specify a penalty. Doesn't the trial court have the discretion to discern what penalty applies?
A penalty should apply in this particular situation.
Well, wasn't one imposed by the sanction related to reduction of the attorney's fees?
That sanction was minuscule in comparison to the effect that it had with exposure of the offer of compromise prematurely.
It had no effect on anything.
It did have an effect.
No, it didn't. Here's what mystifies me about the briefing of the parties. You seem to believe that the kerfuffle about the set-off had something to do with who was entitled to fees under the MARs. I mean, isn't that a basis of your entire argument?
Absolutely. That's part of the argument.
And what did the arbitrator rule with regard to the offset?
There was no determination with regard to the offset.
So since Ronald Reagan's first term, the law has been that only those matters determined by the arbitrator can be compared to matters determined by the jury in order to determine whether or not someone bettered their position under the MARs. So this entire kerfuffle misses a 32-year-old point, which is the offset has nothing to do with who gets fees under the MARs.
With respect to the fees under the MAR, these are sort of apples and oranges.
They're apples and apples because it's 7.06 that covers MAR fee entitlement, and it's 7.06 that directs that there shouldn't be a premature disclosure. So it's apples and apples. And so what happened here is that there was wrongful conduct. There was a premature disclosure, no question about that. But it didn't affect anything, and it couldn't have as a matter of law. So why shouldn't the trial court have discretion to fashion a reasonable remedy?
The trial court does have discretion. Here it abused that discretion by only allowing a certain amount of penalty for that disclosure. And it was not only that disclosure, but it was a direct violation of the motion in limine, which granted State Farm the right to have the offsets determined before judgment was entered.
It wasn't in violation of that. You still had the opportunity to do that. Before judgment was entered, you could have the offset determined. But it didn't have anything to do with who gets MAR fees.
It does have everything to do with MAR.
It has absolutely nothing to do with that. That's the problem with how you litigated your case. And both sides did this, and I just don't understand why. But Christie Lambert case in 1984 says that you take only those issues that are litigated to the arbitrator and compare them with the issues that are litigated to the jury to determine who if someone has bettered their position. That you told me not 5 minutes ago, that the arbitrator didn't rule on the offset. Therefore, whatever the trial court's ruling on the offset was, had nothing to do with who gets MAR fees.
The mistake of the arbitrator does not have a detrimental effect after that. She ruled because there was a verdict an improper decision above the $50,000 MAR limit that an offset was not appropriate. Those issues were raised in the affirmative defenses by State Farm. They were raised at the time of the arbitration, and because the arbitrator's incompetence and failure to do that did not bar State Farm from raising that issue. It raised it throughout the entire case. It raised it in motions in limine as well, and that motion was granted by Judge Oishi.
On this record, though, we've got simply the award by the arbitrator, 20,000 specials, 50,000 generals, 70,000 award, 50,000. We can't tell from that's all we've got. We can't tell from that what a consideration or any mistake the arbitrator may not have made.
That's right. And you also don't know that whether or not she determined what the offsets were, other than I just told you that. Right? That's what I just told you. Because of the decision that was made. That issue was litigated then in the trial court. I didn't see there was no motion by the plaintiff at any point in time to say they are changing the field. And that's what would have to happen in a case of if it was taken into trial after MAR. If there's a changing of the playing field, suddenly this offset was raised and it wasn't raised before. That did not occur. The issue of offset was germane. And the offset was raised during the trial. In a motion limine, it was granted. And the offset was never determined, or the offset was nullified by the fact that the plaintiffs then created fees and costs in excess for which Judge Oishi did nothing to determine whether or not that was reasonable. That goes to our second grounds for the appeal, that Judge Oishi did not do anything to determine that the $15,000 to create that common fund was appropriate. Remember, we're talking about a PIP offset or a common fund of $10,000, out of which $8,400 was admitted. So there was $1,400 in dispute, yet they spent more than $15,000 to put on that case, which nullified the $10,000 offset, which was claimed, which was raised. It was determined.
If, as soon as under the PIP formula, offset formula, once the court takes a look at that and says, you know, fees here are going to easily be over $20,000. That's going to erase any offset for the $10,000 PIP payments. Why isn't that good enough?
Because there needs to be a showing that the judge actually looked and determined that those fees were reasonable in comparison to the determination of what was a cost and a fee. And the judge Oishi did nothing. There's nothing on the record to support that he did anything but rubber stamp the $15,000. There's no discussion by Judge Oishi for that at all. Winters, Ham, Mahler all say they must be reasonable costs in effect to allow the cost sharing analysis under a common fund theory.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm George Arend on behalf of Erica Prince this morning, and we're asking the Court to affirm the trial court in all respects. I'd like to start with Judge Dwyer's question, and I apologize that we didn't cite the Christie Lambert case in our briefing, but I think you're absolutely correct.
Well, in fact, at footnote 12, you say presumably it does make a difference. You didn't take up that issue in your briefing.
Correct, because it wasn't expressly argued in the trial court. But I think, you know, as a matter of interpreting the MAR rules, comparing like to like is the basis for determining whether or not there's an improvement in position, and I would totally endorse what Judge Dwyer has proposed here this morning.
Even accepting that it doesn't have an effect on the determination of MAR fees, there was a discretionary matter arguably pending before the court at the time of the premature disclosure. What is the standard for, doesn't Hernandez teach us that if you frustrate the purpose of the statute by making a premature disclosure, forfeiture is an appropriate remedy? What's the policy of the statute?
It says, so the policy of the statute, there's really, of the MAR fees, it's really three of them. And the first one is to hold parties accountable for using court resources if it's without justification, if they don't improve their position.
More specifically, what's the purpose of the prohibition on premature disclosure?
It's to prevent influencing a discretionary decision by the judge. And I would take issue with the idea that this is a discretionary decision for two reasons. The first is, Mahler says, and I think that this court is bound by what the Supreme Court said in Mahler, and there's two parts of Mahler that discuss fees. But the part that discusses fees awarded or available under the common fund doctrine that reduce the amount of an offset, the Supreme Court said the insurance company has no standing to object to those fees. And the reason is, I mean, in a case like this, so State Farm is an adversary to Erica Prince, and State Farm shouldn't be allowed to interject itself into that attorney-client relationship, especially where this offset...
Well, but it talks about reasonable fees.
It does. Okay. And there's a couple...
So do you seriously envision a trial court engaging in the fact-finding process of determining whether something's reasonable in what is essentially an ex-parte process? No participation, no adversary system at work?
Not only do I contemplate that, I think the RCWs contemplate that. RCW 424005 says that given the terms of the fee agreement between the client and the lawyer, if the client believes that the fees are unreasonable, then that client can petition the court for, it isn't really ex parte at that point because you've got the client on one side and you've got the lawyer on the other side, and that's the forum, that's the party that has standing to object to the fees. But here we've got a case where there is no objection to the reasonableness of the fees by the party charged with paying them. And of course, the client and the lawyer both have strong incentive not to incur unreasonable fees. The lawyer has RPC 1.5, for example, but also we're just talking about a reduction of an offset. It isn't like these fees are incurred with the idea that State Farm or any other insurer in its position is going to then write a check to the plaintiff or the lawyer for these fees. It's merely a partial offset, or in this case a total offset, of a PIP benefits that were paid. And so
So in this scenario, if State Farm can't object to the reasonableness of the fees, no one can, right?
The client can. But in this fact pattern, correct.
The client, and so whatever, in the litigation, the client would pro se file the petition you referred to.
That's what RCW 424005.
So the client has got to go out and get another lawyer to do that for them, or are they actually pro se when this happens?
I think either would be conceivable under the statute, but
seriously, you're saying this to me with a straight face, that you think that this actually is how things could and should work in a superior court on any given Thursday.
It's different than a fee application. When we're talking about calculating, doing the arithmetic to calculate the reduction of a PIP offset, yes, I am saying that with a straight face. And the reason I'm saying that with a straight face is because I think the Washington Supreme Court has already rejected the idea that the insurance company can petition. Presumably a judge could sua sponte inquire, but it certainly isn't the place of the insurance company to do that, and I think we're bound by what the court said in Mahler.
So if the fee agreement is for $1 million, no matter what, unassailable?
Well, so that's obviously not the facts in this case. But
doesn't it illustrate the fundamental flaw in your argument?
No, because that's never happened, and it's not going to happen, given the incentive that the client and the lawyer have to minimize fees, the obligation that the lawyer has under RPC 1.5, subjecting him or her to potential professional discipline, and the statutory mechanism that the legislature has already provided. So, no, I'm not going to tell you that $1 million fees is reasonable, but what I am going to tell you is that's not going to happen, and if it does happen, there are other remedies besides the insurance company objecting to those proportional fees and costs. I don't think any lawyer would stand up there with a straight face and try and reduce a PIP offset with $1 million fee in a case like this. Next we get to, continuing with the forfeiture, Hernandez, this court's decision provided for a forfeiture fee of fees for premature disclosure of an offer, notwithstanding the normal rule that the law abhors a forfeiture. Hernandez says a couple things. The first thing it says is that the forfeiture may be an appropriate remedy. It doesn't provide that it is the sole and exclusive remedy. And, of course, the statute that is being interpreted and applied in Hernandez, and in this case, says that the offer of compromise shall not be prematurely disclosed, but it doesn't say that a forfeiture shall ensue or specify any other consequence as a result of that. And so, as I think the court was intimating in some of its questions, the trial court judge should have discretion to determine if there was any effect, if there wasn't any effect, and then to impose a corresponding sanction.
Why isn't the policy of the statute, the prohibition on premature disclosure of this statute as well as the claims under $10,000 statute with the parallel provision. Why isn't the policy fundamentally say we don't want anyone to be able to throw a stone at the court and say, aha, this disclosure occurred when there were things going on to be decisions to be made, and we suspect the court put their thumb on the scale because they put someone in a bad light, they rejected a reasonable offer of compromise. If that's the purpose, then why wouldn't almost any violation of the premature disclosure law, as long as there's some discretionary question pending, be the basis for forfeiture?
If it is a discretionary question, there's a better argument. But think about what the hypothetical there, or what the policy that you just proposed requires us to assume, that a trial court judge is going, their decision is going to be tainted, and that they're not going to be able to account for that. And I don't know if that's a warranted assumption.
Well, isn't it is there a single case under either of those two statutes where the courts found a violation and not forfeited fees?
Not this reported. No, and not that that I'm aware of that's reached the appellate level. There may be decisions at the trial court level that were on appeal that I'm not aware of. But of course,
the statute doesn't set forth the remedy.
Correct. And so I think this court has discretion, or the trial courts should have discretion, and this court should recognize the discretion of the trial courts to fashion an appropriate remedy up to and including forfeiture. But that's obviously not what the trial court felt was appropriate here. And I also want to point out, this isn't the decision that led to a forfeiture, Hernandez, which is really the only decision we have, involved remittitor, which is a discretionary decision. And, you know, denial of remittitor actually strengthens the jury verdict for purposes of appellate review and has consequences, significant consequences, beyond just the affirmance or denial or the grant of the denial of remittitor. And that decision is very unlike the decision that's required here. Here, it's a math formula. Ham gives us the formula for plugging in the fees and the costs.
If this was a claim that was being stricken prior to the trial on the merits, Burnett would apply. And there'd be that three-step kabuki dance to determine whether or not the claim could be stricken. Should that influence our view on what the trial court should be doing in striking a claim for MAR fees based on the violation?
I think that's a great point, because what it shows is the Supreme Court's sensibility and desire to see that substantial justice is done, not to just have a forfeiture, or like under Seattle versus Jones or Burnett, you know, exclusion of a witness or dismissal of a claim, that you can, to the extent you're able to, you fashion a remedy to ameliorate the prejudice, but otherwise you don't take away the party's ability to have justice done. And here the justice is an unjustified use of the court system and incurring additional expense for the plaintiff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Judge Dwyer, you were the concurrence of the opinion in the Hernandez case.
Mm-hmm.
You were on that case, and that's the precedent that we have here today. And it upheld Doe, it upheld Hansen, it looked to other statutes where a fee was going to be forfeited because of a direct violation of the statute. That situation did occur in this particular case. It was done so.
So are you arguing that the facts are the same, or that Hernandez establishes a per se rule?
The facts are different, the facts are different in how and what, when the or why the occurrence took place. But the disclosure did take place before the judgment occurred, in direct contravention of RCW 7.06.050. The penalty that we have is forfeiture. That was upheld by Hernandez, by this district, in which Judge Dwyer was a concurrent opinion in that.
So your position is Hernandez is basically a per se rule.
It's a rule that would should apply, that the trial court should have looked at and upheld.
Well, the court in its findings of fact and conclusions of law cites Hernandez, cites Hansen. So the court did consider it.
Well, it failed to follow through with the precedent that exists with this court. It failed to follow through with Hansen and Doe and Hernandez.
Let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. If this was a claim that was being asked to be stricken prior to the trial on the merits, the Supreme Court tells us that we should use the three factors from the Burnett case to determine whether or not it should be, the claim should be stricken, or whether something less significant than that should happen, whether it was intentional, those concerns. Is that the construct that we should be using, or should we just be assigning no significance to that and just treating it as a per se rule?
I think it should be looked at as a per se rule in this particular situation. You know, the Burnett factors apply to witnesses or testimony, something that's going to be presented during the course and scope of a trial.
Yeah, they can apply to claims, too. That's
It can apply to claims, but in this particular situation, in this particular statute, someone mentioned it, you put the thumb on the scale, and you know, that statute is here to prevent that thumb from being on the scale, from tilting the scale improperly in this particular case. And that's what happened, and we believe it should be a fee forfeiture. I need to emphasize, too, that the respondent is entitled to having the reasonable fees looked at for the offset in terms of the Mahler amount. And if you were to make a determination that, all right, the minor penalty that was instructed and there is no offset, then the other fees also need to be looked at based on Berryman, and I don't believe that Judge Oichi did that appropriately. This is a small case, $100,000, the hours did not apply.
Thank you both. Next up, I think we're ready now on State v. Hauser.